Today's podcast is brought to you by our friends at Stuart McDonald. They don't give me a script. They just tell me to talk about their products, and that is really easy for me. Their products show up in a lot of Fretboard Journal features. Whether you are a repair person, a luthier, or just a guitar enthusiast, if you head over to stumac.com, I'm sure you will find something intriguing that you may need to add to your arsenal. I know a lot of guitar collectors go for those inspection mirrors so that they can see how sloppy their braces have been glued or if there are any signatures under their tops. I know a lot of people just go to stumac.com to watch the cool videos that Eric Coleman and Dan Erlewine produce pretty regularly. They have so much stuff, I won't even tell you about specific products, but if you are into guitars and need a part or just want to see what products await you in the world of guitar setup and repair, head on over there, and if you order anything, tell them that Jason from the Fretboard Journal sent you. I am Jason. You are listening to the Fretboard Journal podcast. This is our 101st episode, and once again, we're going to be talking to Drew Heininen, the young builder out of Minnesota who is going to be building us a guitar over the next several months. We have a story on fretboardjournal.com penned by Todd Lundberg about Drew. It's up right now. It's got some photos of Drew and some of his creations and his workbench. And it raised a bunch of questions. It actually was really intriguing for me to hear about how Jim Olsen built his guitars and what Drew learned from Dana and a bunch more. So I wanted to follow up with him before we actually get to the nitty-gritty of building this guitar. Drew has also sent us an order form, which I've posted on fretboardjournal.com on this podcast page. And we're going to be building a guitar with him. And the task for you guys is, if you have any feedback on sustainable domestic tone woods, I would love to hear about them. My hope is that we are going to be making a guitar that is unique, that has a little bit of character, has a little bit of vibe to it, and that is built as much as possible from domestically grown woods, something that might open some eyes. So if anyone is sitting on some great stashes of tone wood that are for sale, or God forbid you want to give them away, reach out to me at fretboardjournal.com. It's just Jason at fretboardjournal.com, and I will be happy to talk to you. My hope is that as we build this guitar over the next several months, we're not only talking to Drew every couple of weeks, but we're talking to some of the suppliers. We're talking to some of the people who have given us woods and can share some of their stories, because as you know, a guitar is built of many parts and they come from all over the land. So we'll be hopefully talking to folks at Waverly Tuners and folks who have provided some of the woods. Maybe we'll walk over to Michael Gurian's barge to hear a little bit more from him and more. There is a lot of great content on fretboardjournal.com right now that I encourage you to go check out, including some new videos. We are also going to be unveiling more from the Fretboard Summit. Fretboard Journal 35 is out now. Fretboard Journal 36 is just around the corner. Also, go over to fretboardsummit.com if you want to hear about the next summit. It's taking place October 14th through 16th, 2016 in San Diego. So, Drew, it's been about a week. How is the workshop coming along?
It's coming along pretty good. Making some progress. It can be slow going at times, but we're making progress, getting headway.
What machinery is coming through your doors right now?
I am working on getting the Time Saver thickness sander all set up right now. So getting the electrical run for that, and then have to hook that up to the compressor and the compressed air system to get that functional.
And is this space in your house, or is it at a commercial space?
It's in a garage, in a garage at home.
Got it. So in a weird bit of synchronicity, one of our dear contributors and mutual friends, Todd Lundberg, turned in a story on you. I don't think he was fully aware that we were doing this series, but it was really fascinating to hear his take on how he got to know you. And what was super fascinating was hearing about how Jim Olsen worked and how you worked alongside Jim. One of the things I wanted to ask you about was this concept, because, you know, you're a builder working out of a garage like a lot of builders are. Jim Olsen doesn't operate that way. He's got actual build seasons. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I don't know exactly when He kind of got into this rhythm. Not sure exactly on the history of that for him, but he builds pretty much a batch a year at this point. And so he'll, over the past few years, he'll kind of build up his order list for the year. I know from what I've heard, this year and the past couple years, he hasn't been taking the orders over the winter. He kind of waits until he's going to be starting back up, to get a sense of where how many he wants to build in a year. But he will kind of build up his order list to his capacity and start the guitars. When I was working with him, we would start them in about April, mid-April, and then just take the batch through. And usually we'd be finishing up sometime in September or October, finishing up about 40 at a time. And so you can, under with that system, you can kind of really ramp up your efficiency as far as the build process when you only have to set up your tooling once and then you can utilize it 40 times and then go on to the next process. And so it's a very effective and efficient method of building.
I'm curious, there's a handful of builders who are able to do this, and they obviously have a giant following and are able to afford some CNC machines and some tooling that doesn't really move. As a much smaller scale builder, did any of that stuff stick with you as you're working on your new shop?
Yeah, definitely. It's in general, as I'm thinking about building guitars, I'm kind of thinking of how I can streamline the process and build in batches, and what can I do in setting up my shop and my space to facilitate that. And obviously, at this point, I'm not going to be utilizing CNC machinery yet. We'll see what the future holds as to whether that's ever a feasible option. But it's something that has definitely shaped my build process and how I think about the process as a whole, for sure.
And where is that invisible line where you think, okay, my hands needs to touch this, and my little old school chisel needs to touch this versus some lathe or machinery?
Yeah, it's definitely a delicate balance, and I think a lot of people, I think for as many different builders as there are, you're going to find different answers. In the shops that I've worked in, I think the necks have definitely had portions of them that have had handwork done on them, kind of the final cleaning up of whether it's the volute or the headstock and all the sanding and getting sharp and crisp lines. A lot of that is just comes down to the final handwork. But as far as when you're carving out a neck or, cutting your fret slots, I think that it's very time consuming to shape a neck by hand. And I think realistically, you get more consistent results if you can mechanize it. So that's something that down the line I would be thinking about doing. I don't think that there's a major benefit that you get from a hand-carved neck over a CNC cut neck. So that would be something that I would have no problem turning over to a mechanized process. And you know, there are parts even that are a little more on the hand side, whether it's shaping, carving braces to voice the top. If you can, before you start that process, if you can shape your braces down to a starting point where you can hog away some material before you have to do your final tuning, that's gonna save you time in the long run and energy and less cuts that you have to make with a chisel or with a little finger plane. And so it's gonna save you time, and then you can really put your invest your time elsewhere. And so that's, I mean, I don't think in any, none of the shops I've been at have we CNC cut our braces, even to rough them in. That's usually done on a shaper or a router table or something. But you know, it's things like that that, or you know, shaping a bridge, that I'm at this point doing a lot of my bridge work by hand. Some of it's on a router table to get the footprint, but you know, that's another part of the process that a CNC cut bridge is not going to have a different tonality than a hand carved bridge, really. And if you're doing your, if you do your layout correct and you orient your piece of wood correct in the CNC machine, it's the same as orienting that piece of wood in doing that work by hand. And really, I think one of the added benefits of the CNC is repeatability. That I think I was listening to the podcast that you had with TJ about how his utilizing the CNC and how it every single time it comes off the CNC, it's going to be exactly the dimensions that you plugged in. And there's really something to be said for that.
Yeah, I'm curious when you as you look forward, are you one day gonna nail a neck and be, hey, I'm gonna digitize this one. This one's my pattern. Or how does this even work? I know TJ Thompson kind of talked a little bit about this and mentioned all the headaches he went through to get those bridges exactly right.
That's I mean, I don't, again, I don't know if there's a specific that, like, okay, this is the next shape that you nail it and then you digitize that one. Another nice thing about the CNC is that you can modify it. It can be a challenge to modify the drawings, but you know, you can modify it if you want to switch from a 1 3/4 at the nut to 1 13/16 or 1 11/16. You can just modify that in your drawing, and then and it takes some finagling, and then you have to get it over into a program that controls your cutter heads on the actual programming of the CNC. But so you know, you can make a neck that has a slightly deeper profile or a slightly wider neck, and do that, you know, consistently if you want to make those changes. If a customer asks, if a customer says, you know, I like a more of a V neck or a deeper a D to it, or if they say they like a really flat profile on the back. You know, you can design different necks potentially, and then tell your CNC to cut those that profile, or you can at least get it close and then do the final work by hand, but you've gotten it at least 80-90% of the way there on the CNC.
Got it. So I take it at Jim's shop you did work on the CNC a fair amount.
A little bit. He already had a lot of his programming set. That was something that so he has different NECs programmed in, and so if a customer orders a wider NEC, he can just plug that program in, and when you put in your NEC blank into the machine, you just have to make sure that the right program is plugged in there. And so I wasn't doing any of his programming for sure. But there was, I was loading parts in and out at times.
Sure. So you mentioned our TJ Thompson podcast, and I know you've already heard the audio file, but I think I should play for folks listening to this podcast episode a little bit about what TJ said about what makes a good OM guitar, as well as a little bit about our talk about tone woods.
Yeah.
I would say know your wood. Most luthiers call the luthiery supply shop and say, send me a Engelmann top or send me a Red Spruce top. And for me, that's not where I like to start. I like to start with selecting the tree, cutting it, and then seasoning the wood myself. So that's really where it starts for me, how you cut and season that top. And when you visit my shop someday, it's going to be a fun day. And one thing that you'll notice right away is I have guitar tops vertically stored all around the perimeter of the ceiling, so the air can circulate. So that's part of it. I mean, these are tops I cut 10 years ago, and they're still seasoning.
Yeah.
But year after year, you pull those tops down, and they just have more and more of what I want in the guitar. So I don't know. Does that sort of answer?
Yeah.
Anything
else?
Question?
Anything else further along in the wood in the process that separates the men's from the boys?
Well, let's see. Other than wood selection, I would say, I would say good joinery, so your parts are mated, well and properly.
Yeah.
And some people think that hide glue is really important. I'm not so sure that that's. I've made guitars with regular aliphatic resin glue that sounded as good as my hide glued guitar. So I'm not sure that that's really all that important. But I do think that having the surfaces mate well is really important. For instance, if you're using a Martin style top, and there's a radius in the top, right? It's not flat. It's, even though it's called a flat top, it's not really flat. And then you take a bridge that is flat, and you can see the problem, right? How are you supposed to glue this flat bridge to the radius top? It's not such a big deal on the Martin guitar. You can actually do it, but on the Gibson style guitars that have braces that are radius even more, if somebody's just clamping that down, you can picture what's happening, right?
Yeah.
They're forcing this stress into the top. That can affect the tone as much or more than anything, just that small step. So if you match those parts so that you're not forcing them, and you can imagine that the bridge is trying to pull itself off too.
Yeah.
The whole time, right? So if you mate those parts well, or you match the base surface of the bridge, the curve of the top, those kind of things can affect the end result as much as anything.
So, as folks hopefully just heard, TJ talked a little bit about knowing your woods. And I guess that segues perfectly into the discussion of this guitar we're talking about. Where do you typically buy your woods from? I've been window shopping and thinking about this OM guitar, I've been kind of plugging in keywords into Google all the time, and I've been sent to stores on eBay. I've been sent to the LMIs. I've kind of like poked around all the usual suspects and internet forums. Where are you typically buying your wood from if a customer's placing an order?
Well, it kind of depends on what they're looking for. At this point, I don't have a list in front of me, but I'd say probably 20 to 30 different sources for materials that I'm pulling from for each guitar. So it varies from part to part on what I'm getting from what supplier. As far as tone woods, I've kind of been fortunate to date, at least, to be able to have connections from other builders, partially because then I'm knowing that they've had that wood sitting around for a few years at least. There's some a few wood dealers that I have worked with. I like to, as much as I can, to get to their lumber yard or to go and feel some of the wood and really get a sense of what it is that I'm purchasing to use. I'm a little bit leery about ordering anything tone wood wise sight unseen. And without feeling it, flexing it, tapping it, to a certain point, it's not feasible to do that 100% of the time. But I think as far as, and then, you know, finding trusted and reputable dealers, guys that have been out there doing it for, you know, a number of years, and who, when you look at who they're supplying, and I can say, like, okay, I trust that they know their stuff. So whether it's, you know, Pacific Rim Tone Woods, or Colonial Tone Woods, you know, there's many really good tone wood dealers that are out there that that have good instrument building woods.
And what, you know, TJ mentioned seasoning the wood, which of course he has the luxury of doing because people right. are very patient for TJ Thompson built guitars. Do any of these suppliers ever promise or claim to, you know, sit on this wood and season it for a while?
Not that I know of. I guess I haven't really inquired too much about that with them as to whether they know exactly when it was harvested and how long it's been around in their shop or in their how long they've had it, how long it's been milled, how long, you know, I have not yet asked that question of a wood dealer.
Sure. Maybe I should ask that and be the hard-hitting journalist. I want to play a little bit of what TJ mentioned about alternative woods, because he says a sentiment that a lot of people echo, but I'm going to play it right now.
Okay.
Have you, on your own guitars, played with any non-traditional woods?
Oh, no. I wish. I really wish I could. Someday I hope to, because I would love to make a guitar out of cherry. My dad made a guitar out of ash one time. Yeah. That was really cool, because he wasn't bound by sort of traditional expectations that I am. So I thought it was beautiful. I mean, the grain was really pronounced, but it was a very nice guitar. I think it would be really fun. I just can't afford to do it because nobody's going to want to pay.
Yeah.
As much as they would for a Brazilian guitar or, you know, some other traditional wood.
Yeah. We're talking about using some alternative woods just to, you know, not compete, not have people compare this thing to a Martin, basically.
Yeah. I would love, that would be my first choice. I'd love to do that. I have walnut, quarter sawn walnut that I got from my dad that I really would look forward to making a guitar with someday.
So what I hear from a lot of builders is there are all these great alternative and domestic tone woods out there, but that they just can't sell them. And TJ said that as well. And it was interesting to hear him mention, you know, that he'd like to build a guitar with cherry if he thought he could sell it. And he mentioned walnut as well. Do you hear that from other builders? Did you experience that when, you know, working alongside Jim?
Yeah, I mean, in Jim's shop especially, there was not a terrible amount of variety in the alternative tone woods. The vast majority of what we were building was rosewood instruments. We'd have a handful of either maple or mahogany or a cowrie. And you know, there were a handful of other tone woods. I think at Dana's shop, we had a wider variety of tone woods that we were using, on a regular basis. But still, most of it kind of fell within the realm of still somewhat traditional, whether it was an ebony or a mahogany or a rosewood. I have definitely experienced that just in my own instruments as far as building with, say, Padauk, and then and really enjoying the tone wood, but then hearing from dealers as I'm kind of starting to market it, to like, well, you know, not a whole lot of interest out in the market for Padauk instruments, just because it's not your traditional tone wood.
Yeah. What was Padauk like as a tone wood? How would you characterize it?
Well, I think that it's very similar to a rosewood, whether it's like a Honduran rosewood or Panama rosewood, something in that range, Cocobolo-y. Really, it's really responsive. It's fairly dense. It has gigantic pores, which I think was the most difficult part of using it, was the finish process, just because the pores in the wood were so large. It was a little bugger to fill. But I really like it as a tone wood, but I'm not sure how much of a market there is for it, and so and then B, how much I want to keep using it as a wood. I have nothing against it, but I have a lot of guitars I want to, other guitars that I want to try building, and so.
Cool. Well, you know, in the last couple of weeks since our first conversation, you sent me the build order spec sheet, and that looked all self-explanatory. It was asking various questions about what kind of tuners would you like, you know, what style, what scale length. I'll be filling that out and sending it to you. I might have some upgrades, but yeah, on this tone wood front, you know, I'd really like to open it up for the next week to our, you know, our Facebook audience and our podcast listeners. If anyone has any ideas about an alternative and perhaps a domestic and a sustainable tone wood that might be great for this OM style guitar, We would love to hear about it. No guarantees that we'll follow your what you're rallying for, but and I guess if anybody is stockpiling some wood and it's sitting on some wood that might be for sale, this would be a good time for you to raise your hand and tell us. Drew, what do you think about cherry as a tone wood, just to go back to what TJ was talking about?
Yeah, I have done some work with cherry in building cabinets in my past, but I haven't seen and held and tapped a cherry back and side set at all. So I guess I would be really interested in seeing a guitar or hearing a guitar that had it, and hearing from anybody that had experience with it, as to whether kind of where on a tonal spectrum it falls. I think it can definitely be a gorgeous wood.
Yeah.
And have great grain patterns and a great color tone to it just naturally. So I would be interested in exploring that for sure.
Yeah, I mean, that cherry seems to come up a lot when I go down these rabbit holes and get lost in these internet forums. Walnut is obviously talked about a lot. There's the Chiave wood that we talked about at the summit. There's this Osage orange, I believe. I don't know how you pronounce that, people keep talking about. And it seems like, you know, on the vanguard of these guitars with these woods, there seems to be like a trio of luthiers, maybe a few more that I'm forgetting, but Tim McKnight's name comes up a lot, Alan Carruth, Randy Muth, John Arnold, certainly. These are guys who have been at it for many years and have tried a lot of these woods. Do you agree that they kind of are the ones who seem to keep pushing the envelope a little bit?
Yeah, I think from the research that I've done on kind of in that vein, those are the names that on my end as well have really popped up on forums or and you know that from what they have said, it sounds like they're achieving good results and results that they're satisfied with, and there it sounds like they're still using the stuff, which that has to say something.
Yeah, and I'm curious, I guess my final question before we open the floodgates to feedback, criticism, and comments from our listeners and readers is, you know, this wood is relatively, a set of Brazilian rosewood might cost, if you friends and family discount, $700 up to several thousand dollars, depending on where you're getting it from. Most of these back and side sets can be had for under $100. I mean, who knows if they've been seasoned properly or not. If we had three or four of these and sent them to you, how much can you tell from just the raw wood that's kind of roughly the thickness you're going to want it to be for a guitar? Can you kind of just, by tapping or staring or looking at the grain pattern as a builder, can you kind of figure out what you need to do bracing wise and top wise and all that? Or is it still kind of a mystery to you?
Most of the bracing, I guess kind of alchemy to it, has already been established, as at least in my particular build style, and the theory that is that it's based on a lot of kind of what the guitar is historically. So I'm not necessarily changing my bracing pattern at all based on the tone wood, but definitely getting a sense of, and it's definitely the feel. When I hold a set of wood of kind of judging from its weight and how flexible it is, how stiff it is, and tapping it and seeing how responsive it is, and then getting it's at really at that point that I feel comfortable gauging the quality of the tone wood. I don't think I would be able to quantifiably say through looking at a picture, say online, that, oh yeah, that's going to be a great piece of tone wood. I can say that that has amazing grain and it's a beautiful piece of wood and it would make a beautiful instrument visually, but whether or not it's going to really have the tonal qualities of that upper echelon instrument, for me, that I'd need it in my hands. But I think at that point, you can really, you can deduce a lot just from when it's still in raw lumber form.
Great. That's great to hear. Well, I think at this point, we're going to open the floodgates and get some feedback. And maybe, like I said, if anyone's sitting on a wood stash that they'd like to open up to us, we'd certainly be interested in talking to you. But I would love to get some feedback, and people can email me at jason@fretboardjournal.com in terms of what alternative, sustainable, perhaps domestic woods you've enjoyed, what have been surprising, and what you'd like to see in this Fretboard Summit guitar that we will be passing around and sharing to a much wider audience. So if anyone has feedback, jason@fretboardjournal.com is the way to do that. Drew, do you have anything to add between now and the next time we chat? I will fill out that spec sheet, I promise.
Yeah, that would be great. And I filled in a few just kind of stock things, but feel free if there's anything on that list that we want to change or alter, certainly nothing on that is set in stone.
I may want to upgrade to Waverly's. That was one thing. But everything else looked pretty good.
That is totally doable.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Drew.
Not a problem. Thank you, Jason.
Looking forward to talking to you next week.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, bye.
Bye.